and turn biomass in lime. Woodboilers.com.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and here are some of the voices from this week's headlines.
I think it makes sense to look at whether we should use a portion of the surplus to address some of those cuts. But we'll work with the Senate and the House. Again, it's really important that we do build back up the rainy day fund.
On a typical 24-hour statewide storm, our crews travel 85,000 miles to maintain 4,600 miles of state highway. That's the equivalent of 9 round trips between Concord, New Hampshire and Anchorage, Alaska.
Many ideas have been suggested, from direct assistance to fishermen who've been affected by it. Some industry groups have suggested capacity reduction or a buyout to allow people to exit the industry. Others have suggested things like cooperative research. So there's no shortage of ideas.
The other thing that's part of the legislation is a piece that would encourage universities and colleges to do a better job of keeping you up to date on what's happening with your student loans so that you know more about what the impact of those student loans are.
She is dedicated and committed to every single one of her constituents in that community and fights hard for them. And she has been so tough and so strong during this whole thing. She has just, you know, done her very best not to give in to it.
From the top, that was Governor Maggie Hassan on how she thinks a $15 million surplus should be allocated. State Transportation Spokesman Bill Boynton on the stresses of this year's snow removal budget. Federal Fisheries Atlantic Administrator John Bullard on how to spend a $33 million disaster relief fund for Northeast fishing communities. U.S. Senator Gene Shaheen at UNH this week talking about student debt. And State Senator Nancy Stiles on State Representative Amy Perkins of Seabrook, who died this week after struggling with brain cancer. Again, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. What's your take on some of the stories we'll cover, whether these headlines or the prospect of Defense Department budget cuts hitting the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard, the return of Republican Bob Smith into New Hampshire's U.S. Senate race, or a possible reality TV show featuring our very own Hampton Beach. The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Our guests for this week's roundup are Kevin Landrigan, political reporter at the Telegraph of Nashua. And Kevin, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Great to be back, Laura.
Also, Josh Rogers, senior political reporter for us here at NHPR. And Josh, thanks for making the time.
Good morning, Laura.
And Dean Spiliota, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, welcome back.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, and gentlemen, let's start with medical marijuana and a decision by the Attorney General's office this week not to issue IDs for eligible patients at this point in time. Josh, what's going on here?
Well, there's a difference of opinion, at least among some who are deeply engaged in this issue, about the what the law meant vis-a-vis qualifying patients and what an ID would entitle them to do, as written in the opinion of the Attorney General's office and some drafters of the bill. The law said, you know, you would only be qualified to receive medical marijuana from a licensed dispensary. That was something that was very important to Governor Hassan, and that therefore these cards would only entitle you to receive the marijuana from these licensed dispensaries. Those aren't going to be running for, you know, hard to know when exactly, but at least a year. Advocates for this for medical marijuana say that they would were hoping and that it was their belief that it was intended that ID cards for qualifying patients would be issued before that, and that those cards might provide a measure of protection for patients who are getting medical marijuana elsewhere.
Yeah. So the AG, though, it seems like Josh said, look, we're putting the cart before the horse. What's the point of giving people IDs for medical marijuana if these official dispensaries, the only place where you can legally buy it, are not even open yet?
Well, precisely. And you know, the rules have yet to be finalized on this, and that's going to be interesting to watch, the sort of push and pull over people. And there is certainly an appetite. I mean, the legislature passed bills that were more permissive than what Governor Hassan agreed to sign, and they're bills that would make medical marijuana more permissive than the statute that is on the books. And so it'll be interesting to watch how this develops.
Yeah, Dean, how much is this affected by the fact that New Hampshire, unlike some other states, is relying just on these four dispensaries instead of the Grow Your Own?
Right, and the Grow Your Own was a big part of the debate. It's something that proponents wanted, but Governor Hassan, at least at this point, was opposed to. You know, this was one of the concerns that we heard back when this was being debated, the concern that it might take up to 2 years to get the program up and running, and that caused grave concerns for people with medical conditions who need the treatment now. You know, I thought this argument that we're hearing about the cards providing a measure of protection, I guess the idea being if you're busted with marijuana, having the card may give you a get out of jail free card, or you may face some sort of lesser penalty. You know, I think if that were the case and if that were clearly stated, I think Governor Hassan would have been unlikely to support the bill. So it's an interesting idea, but my sense is that, you know, the AG is saying that, no, that's putting the cart before the horse, as you said.
Again, you can join us on this story and many others that we're covering in our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Kevin Landrigan, compare this process here in New Hampshire to other New England states, which already have medical marijuana laws in the books. We were the last to go this route.
We were. And several New England states have homegrown options. Massachusetts does not. They're in the process now of licensing their dispensaries up to 20 dispensaries. Maine has Grow Your Own. And that's clearly what the sponsors wanted. This is really a casualty of the volunteer legislature. That's what happened here.
What do you mean by that, Kevin?
Well, what I mean is this is an extremely bad law. It was written very badly, and here's why. This, as Dean points out, this was a grow-your-own legislation. It was that way until it got to the state Senate, where Governor Hassan made it clear, and she had made it clear earlier, that I'd veto a bill that has the homegrown option in it. So they surgically went to work, and instead of taking a scalpel, they essentially took a meat cleaver and removed all the homegrown references to the bill, but still left in a lot of kind of procedural, structural things that would happen if you were having a homegrown law. That's why this bill, as Norma Love, one of the regulars on News Roundup, pointed out in a story today, that's why the legislation calls for rules for ID cards to be developed up to a year before you've actually licensed centers. Now, that doesn't make any sense with the law now, because you're not supposed to have an ID card until after a center is licensed and can dispense the medical marijuana to you. But these changes weren't made to the law. Like I said, it was just kind of hacked away at. And when we got to a conference committee trying to settle the differences between the House and the Senate, some House members, Jim McKay, who was one of the House leaders on this topic, essentially was pointing out some of these problems with it, and senators made it clear, if you make any changes to what the Senate has passed, we won't sign the conference committee. So there was no ability to try and write a properly drafted law. The Telegraph did a series last summer after the law was passed, and it was one of the stories we'd done was about how difficult this bill was, this law now, was to decipher, because it was so disjointed.
That's interesting.
So many contradictions embedded into it. And this was one of those contradictions.
So the changes, the rewrite, so to speak, wasn't a comprehensive rewrite, Kevin. It was just sort of a slash here, insert there. And
Now
we're feeling the effects of that.
We are.
Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Kevin, I did want to ask you about another big story this week, a do-not-call settlement. Now, we haven't heard about New Hampshire's do-not-call list for a long time. This has to do with who can and who cannot call New Hampshire residents. Always during dinner, it seems. What was this all about?
Yeah, the Bureau of Securities Regulation came down pretty hard against the Edward Jones Investment Company with fines and fees amounting to $750,000. It was the largest such fine against him. Like you said, we thought some time ago we were over this, meaning you get on the Do Not Call registry and you don't get called. Well, the listeners out there are well aware that it's an inexact science, to be sure. We often continue to be called by companies after we've said we don't want to be on the do not call list. It's one of the most, to the Federal Trade Commission, it's one of the most complained issues every single year in the past 5 years.
Okay. Well, big settlement this week. Anybody know where the money's going to go, Josh? That's the other thing. There are these big settlements.
I'm not certain of that. Do you know, Kevin?
Well, about $200,000 of it pays for the investigation. The rest goes into the securities fund. And as Josh knows, the Bureau of Securities Regulation is one of those agencies that actually generates a fair amount of revenue. Much more revenue than it costs to operate the function. And
there have been questions about how some of these settlements have been spent, and where the money should go, and how the money is apportioned. So I'm sure people will be looking at where this one goes.
Yeah. So it's not like individual homeowners who were annoyed during a particular special dinner are going to get an extra $5 or $10 saying sorry, we bothered you.
No, I mean,
sorry,
some of this money, that. I mean, certainly during the Securities Bureau's long-running issues with and prosecution of the local government center, some of the budget from that has come from collections through the years. And, they say that's a reasonable, it's money that goes back to enforcing the law. But $750,000 is a lot of money.
All right. Well, speaking of government funds, coming up, we'll talk about what to do with the state's $15 million surplus. The governor says half should go toward Health and Human Services to restore cuts there and half to the state's emergency rainy day fund. Republicans say the entire amount should go into that rainy day fund. After a short break, tell us what you think. Do you agree with the governor? Do you agree with the Senate, which says put it all in the rainy day fund? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. Sign up your team for NHPR's second annual Trivia Smackdown. Flex your memory for minutia, and maybe you could be this year's champ. Spaces fill up quickly, so visit nhpr.org now to enter your team. This event made possible in part by NEEPCO. New Hampshire weather, sunny and cold today. High temperatures in the teens, mostly clear, cold tonight. Lows from around 16 below in northern Coos County, ranging to around zero toward the Mass border. Partly sunny tomorrow, clouding up in the afternoon in southern parts of the state. Highs lower 20s north, ranging lower 30s in the south. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank. Customized business banking for businesses, professionals, municipalities, and not-for-profit organizations online at centrixbank.com. And Vineyard Brands importers of La VFM wines from Fami Perrin of the Southern Rhone Valley, available at New Hampshire State liquor stores, lavfm.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're covering some of the stories that made headlines this week, from disagreement over when to issue ID cards for medical marijuana. Former Senator Bob Smith preparing to kick off his campaign to regain his old U.S. Senate seat. And we'll also talk in just a moment about the debate over how to spend the state's $15 million surplus. You can join us on those topics and more. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.com. NHPRExchange.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And gentlemen, let's go to the phones, and Kevin's joining us from Meredith. Hi, Kevin, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I really enjoy your show, by the way. Anyway, what I thought was an important point here was that we really should legalize marijuana. It's really important. I mean, if you just look at what they've done in Colorado or in Washington State, they're actually, you know, taxing the sale of it and gaining a large revenue for the state. And in a, you know, changing, obviously the federal government has decided that they're going to legalize marijuana eventually. And, you know, all the rest of the other progressive states have already seen this. All the states in New England have already decided that this should be at least decriminalized or, you know, do anything that just stops putting people in prison for the use of it, because it doesn't make sense. You're spending money to put people in prison for it, plus you're, you know, denying people the medical use of it. It just doesn't make any sense. And, you know,
Kevin, thanks for the call. And, you know, this is something we talked a couple weeks ago, Dean Spiliotis, a lot about, not only on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, but with Governor Hassan. She did indicate she might look at decriminalization, but she was pretty hard and fast about no to legalization, Dean.
Right, and that's an important distinction, I think, that is often lost on people who are only sort of paying tangential attention to this. Decriminalization is the idea that if you get caught or stopped with some small amount of marijuana on your person, you know, you pay a small fine instead of a larger potential penalty. And then legalization is just making it legal, selling it in stores like we're seeing in Colorado and also out in Washington State. It's interesting, you know, we may be headed in that direction eventually. I think that we really need to kind of see how the medical marijuana experience kind of ramps up in the state. It's, you know, taking a while. It was interesting, the governor of Colorado, I think it was Colorado, released some pretty large revenue figures from the taxation. You know, you can tax marijuana 20-25%, make a nice chunk of revenue, but the governor of Colorado also said other states should tread carefully and watch us very closely, because there are all sorts of kind of unanswered questions. You're dealing with something that is still illegal federally, and it's just there are a lot of unintended consequences. So, you know, we may get to decrim or even legalization at some point in the state. Public opinion seems to be trending that way in the state, but there are all kinds of sort of regulatory pitfalls that we're already seeing just in trying to write the rules on a very narrow medical marijuana bill, let alone think of what we would have to do to write decrim or legalization.
Kevin, thanks a lot for calling in. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And next is Bobby calling in from Londonderry. Hi, Bobby. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine, thanks. Go ahead, Bobby.
Good. Well, I'm calling in to discuss the surplus of funds in the budget, and really feel I agree with the governor. I think that half of that money should be put into health and human services. There's a huge need for mental health services throughout our state. I believe that the funding should go into DHHS and that RFPs should be put forth so that we can have money at the community level for case management and for services for the large number of individuals that are not getting the mental health services that they need in our state. We don't have enough beds. We don't have enough staffing. And so we could really use that money. And this is an opportunity for New Hampshire to do that.
Okay, so a vote for putting some of that money back into health and human services. Just to remind us, Josh, if you could, please, Governor Hassan's been talking about what are called back-of-the-budget cuts to health and human services. Explain that to the average layperson who isn't quite sure what, you know, back-of-the-budget cuts
means. These are reductions that were made, you know, essentially a directive to the commissioner to find savings. You know, you're closer to this than we are, basically, or
not
we don't
specified.
Have the stomach to, you know, find savings in the budget. And that's a, you know, budget season tradition, basically, at this point. And, you know, the governor made it clear at the time that she would have favored putting more money back into the budget. And, you know, now that when the surplus came in, she said, and Democrats did, that this is what we ought to do. You know, the state, as to Bobby's point, the state has had its issues with mental health and looking to sort of beef up services that, you know, as part of a settlement agreement. And, you know, Republicans say we need to put the money in the rainy day fund. There's not enough. We don't have much of a rainy day fund. It puts our bond rating at risk. And, it's you know, the season is still young on this kind of thing, but it is hard to see Republicans being inclined to move on this.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because NHPR reported that the state Senate has already killed a bill, Josh, that would have used part of the surplus to restore these HHS cuts. So does this proposal, this push by Hassan, have any chance at all?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting notion to even describe it as a push because, like, it's unclear to me. Maybe Kevin has some thoughts on this about how much she's actually pushing because she may know that a push is fruitless.
Kevin?
I think that's probably true, Josh. And the state treasurer has been pretty outspoken about this. Catherine Paventure has essentially said, look, our debt limit is not alarmingly high, but it's not low either. Meanwhile, states should have up to 5% of annual reserves in a rainy day fund for fiscal emergencies. That would be about $100 million in
really?
A rainy day fund.
Well, I was going to ask you how much you have?
Right, yeah. Right now there's only $9 million in a rainy day.
So it's pretty skinny.
It's pretty skinny, and this is a big sticking point with new Senate President Chuck Morris. He wanted to put more money in the rainy day fund as they were closing this budget. Realized that in order to balance it, we had to make more cuts in the back of the budget, as Josh pointed out. I really think I think the only approach that has any chance, and I still think it's a very slim chance, but going back to Bobby's point, as we've talked about here on the program, the state settled a federal lawsuit regarding mental health care. The bill is coming due. It's going to be about $30 million over a four-year period, and in the first year, it's about $6 million. So I think there's going to be an aggressive effort by House Democrats. They may actually drop this idea of the back of the budget, restoring those back of the budget cuts, but rather making a down payment on the lawsuit and using some of the surplus money to do that.
All right. Well, Bobby, thanks for joining us. And let's take another call. This is Chris in Londonderry. Hi, Chris. Thanks for calling The Exchange. You're on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup.
Hi. Great show, by the way.
Good. Go ahead.
So with a rapidly decreasing youth population in the state and a pretty substantial elderly population increasingly getting older, I think we should look at the extra surplus money we make and put it aside for the emergency situations or eventually where we have such a low population with tax dollars coming in that we have some extra money around just in case of emergencies, you know, elderly people up north without oil or anything like that.
So I'm not sure exactly where you're saying we should spend it. Put it in the rainy day fund, given the aging population and future needs that might arise because of that.
Absolutely. And I think that we should actually look forward to making putting more of our money away when we can, whenever we get these surpluses, eventually having that extra rainy day money for I always hear these horror stories about elderly running out of oil and not knowing who to reach out to. And I think we should actually start pivoting to cater to that situation.
Okay, well, this is interesting, and it kind of relates to what Kevin said, Dean, that the folks on Wall Street anyway who rate our financial status and issue bonds and so forth based on that status like to see more.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny. I thought the caller was going to suggest because New Hampshire's aging and we have this outflow of young people that we create some sort of fund to encourage young people to stay in New Hampshire after they graduate from college or after they leave high school. We've talked about that a lot in recent weeks, about the need to kind of keep the younger population plugged into the state for economic reasons. I suppose you could do that through the rainy day fund. There are probably ways to direct money into these other types of programs to help out, whether it's heating oil or other types of services. But in general, you know, I agree. I think that this idea of despite the bill coming due, as Kevin said, on the mental health settlement, I think that there's going to be real resistance, particularly among Republicans in the Senate, to doing this. This has always been the case that whenever, you know, Democratic governors typically suggest putting some of the surplus often HHS is the agency that seems to come up. And Republicans typically say, no, let's put it in the rainy day fund.
Well, and there's some good election year messages here.
Sure. Absolutely right. You know, you basically to run for re-election and, you know, if you're a Democrat and say that you're sort of funding these services that are important to people and that's kind of the role of the state government, and Republicans who want to show that, you know, we're spending frugally and fits right into sort of the kind of pre-existing narratives of the two parties.
Well, in the existence of – I mean, this budget has been something that both sides, both parties have pointed to is indications of the way that, you know, Concord is not like Washington and we can work together. And certainly it's going to be something that – that, you know, Governor Hassan's going to be talking about as she runs for reelection, and it's certainly going to be something that the Senate Republicans are going to be talking about. It is often the case that, I mean, there hasn't been much public fighting about this, and but the, you know, we're talking about a pretty small amount of money in the scheme of a large budget. We're talking about, you know, $11 billion, and we're talking about, you know, whether you spend $7 million or not. That isn't to say that that money, you know, doesn't have a meaningful effect on, you know, program X, Y, or Z, but it's a pittance within the scheme of things.
All right. Well, and speaking of politics, I did have a couple political headlines that I wanted to follow up on with you guys. And to you first, I think, Josh, there could be another Republican in addition to Andrew Hemingway competing for the Republican gubernatorial nomination. This came out first in John DeStazo's Granite Status column in the Union Leader. So who is it?
Well, Walter Havenstein, who was a leader of BAE Systems, establishment Republican donor, certainly, well-known among, prolific, lives in Alton, retired now, has been involved with Dean Kamen's First Foundation. I was watching him on YouTube, speeches he's given to business groups to get a sense of like what he might be like. And he's, you know, well-spoken, former Marine, engineering background, no experience in elective office, which is always interesting, can work very well for some politicians. Think John Lynch, can work less well for others. You don't really know until you see them there. But this is somebody who, you know, had 50,000 people working under him at one point. So
BAE Systems, major New Hampshire employer.
Yeah, I mean, it is an interesting mix. It's, I guess we'll see if he gets in the race. He's looking at it, but it's like certainly different than Andrew Hemingway, who comes out of the Tea Party, sort of liberty wing of the party, and is, you know, a young man at 32. So
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because Kevin Landrigan, what is the narrative if Mr. Havenstein jumps in? What's the sort of GOP primary narrative with him versus Andrew Hemingway?
Yeah, I think it's Josh sort of laid it out, but it's essentially a renegade against an establishment figure. We've got a checkered history with that in the Republican primaries. I mean, sometimes renegade candidates can win. More often than not, establishment ones do if they're conservative enough. I think the 2010 U.S. Senate race was the best example of that. Ovid Lamontagne was clearly the favorite of the conservative base voter in the Republican Party. But during the primary, Kelly Ayotte earned her chops. She clearly had the support of the establishment, and she narrowly won that primary.
And she staked out some pretty conservative. I mean, that whole primary was pretty much, you know, and it was 2010, a big year for conservatives. But it would be interesting to watch.
Yeah, I think it will be. We're not sure, like Josh said, we're not sure how he's going to perform. But he's a scary candidate for Governor Hassan. He's got a military record. He's a successful businessman like John Lynch, and more importantly, like John Lynch, no political baggage, no voting record. He's a blank slate. He can essentially define himself now. If he wants to be more socially moderate and very fiscally conservative, he could present real problems.
All right. Well, speaking of Republicans, Dean Spiliotis, I did want to ask you about former New Hampshire U.S. Senator Bob Smith getting ready, we hear, to jump in with both feet in his latest attempt to win back his old U.S. Senate seat. He's going to make an announcement early next week, I think on Tuesday. The last time, Dean, Bob Smith was in office was more than a decade ago. So just give us a reminder of Smith's political resume. A lot of people listening might not remember who Bob Smith was.
That's right. Well, he was a two-term U.S. senator. He lost in the Republican primary to Johnny Sununu in 2002 in that race. And Sununu went on to beat Governor Gene Shaheen to take the Senate seat, the Senate seat now held by Gene Shaheen. He's sort of interesting footnote in his career. He ran for president in the 2000 cycle and sort of dropped out of the Republican Party briefly and ran as an independent, then dropped out of the race and came back into the Republican Party when he had an opportunity to take over a Senate chairmanship. He retired to Florida. He's also run briefly for a Senate seat in Florida. He's flirted several times with running for office. It's interesting, you know, when he is, in fact, kicking off his campaign on Tuesday. You know, in some sense, this race has kind of been frozen in place to the extent that we've even talked about it at all. It's been in the context of Scott Brown, who would, you know, be a very strong presence in the race were he to get in. We don't know what he's going to do. Bob Smith is someone that when I talk to voters around the state, they say, well, you know, I'll sort of believe it when I see it, because he sort of flirted many times before with getting back into politics. Sounds like he's serious. I've seen him out and about a little bit. You know, I'm interested to see. It's been over 10 years. The state has changed dramatically demographically over those 10 years.
And politically.
And politically. Yeah, and sort of they go hand in hand. You know, is he going to be sort of old school, or does he have kind of a new take on why he should be back in office? We'll see.
All right. Again, the number here in the exchange for you to join us on that story and the others we're covering during our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Okay, pardon the corny segue, but speaking of frozen in place, as you all know, it's been a pretty cold winter, pretty snowy winter. And there were two headlines that caught our attention this week related to the winter. Josh Rogers, first of all, wood pellet companies seem to be running out.
Well, at least running out. If you are buying wood pellets at the retail level at a big box store, a hardware store, or an Agway, or some such, it's been hard to put your hands on them lately. You know, obviously the cold winter's part of that. The rise in pellet heat generally is part of it.
More people using these,
and you know, it's been tough for people who are buying them in small amounts. I mean, people who have pre-buy contracts have apparently been having less of an issue, but. It's interesting to watch. I mean, certainly pellet stoves have become more popular, and for the time being, it's people have been having to, you know, circuit ride in search of bags of pellets.
Circuit ride for wood pellets. Well, and I was interested to know just from our reports, Josh, that you could pre-buy wood pellets just like you do pre-buy oil. I didn't know that. So
yes.
Some more numbers came out, Kevin Landrigan, this week on the Department of Transportation's road salt budget, and they don't add up very well. Dollars for road salt versus inches of snow. What did we hear from the department this week?
Yeah, the... we're only 65% through the winter. I know that's hard to, for people to accept that are listening to that. But the snow budget is already 80% gone in the Department of Transportation. We're rolling three-year average is a typical winter. That's about 52 inches. We've already gotten 67 inches and more on the way this weekend. The Department of Transportation has already gone to the legislature and said we need $1.5 million more. They got it. They're going to come back again. They're probably going to need another $3, maybe $4 million to close out this snow season.
Well, and coming up, we're going to talk about a couple Seacoast-related stories. As we do, I just want to acknowledge the death this past week of State Representative Amy Perkins, 43 years old, died of brain cancer, represented Seabrook with her husband, a fellow state rep, since 2008. So just want to do a little remembrance and appreciation for Representative Amy Perkins on the Seacoast. Coming up, the prospect of Defense Department cuts raises Seacoast concerns about the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard. Let us know what you think, if it's time to tighten the DOD's belt. Should the shipyard be part of that or not? Let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio. It's 9:39. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. A new Pentagon budget scales back the Army to pre-World War II levels. And Arizona's governor vetoes a controversial anti-gay bill. Then rival protesters clash in Ukraine's Crimea region. All coming up on The Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from your listeners, and support also comes to us from Edward Jones, a financial services firm serving individuals and business owners. Edward Jones, making sense of investing, a member of SIPC. From Downs Racklin Martin, offering statewide trust and estate services with attorneys Tom Shatari, Jake Wheeler, and Wilhelmine Digmans Miller. Information at drm.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. As we cover some of the top headlines of the week, we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. We cover some of the political news, including former Senator Bob Smith perhaps joining the campaign to regain his old U.S. Senate seat. Also, the name of a newcomer to Republican politics, Walter Havenstein, might run for governor on the Republican side. We've also looked at the disagreement over when to issue ID cards for medical marijuana. You can join us on those stories and more at 1-800-892-6477. And gentlemen, Defense Department cuts have made some on the Seacoast nervous. And Dean Spiliotis, if you could just back up, what's the big picture here? Chuck Hagel making big news, proposing major cuts to his department.
That's right. And the base closure issue is just one part of a much larger rollback in Department of Defense spending. The Obama administration, you know, is proposing these cuts. You know, we're out of Iraq, we're winding down Afghanistan. So their argument is that we need to move back to kind of a pre-war financial footing. It's caused a lot of sniping from conservatives who believe that it's going to kind of weaken our preparedness to deal with conflicts around the world. But that being said, so the issue is part of this defense budget cut package are going to be base closing. So we go through this periodically. The Portsmouth Naval Shipyard is occasionally on the chopping block. Got 4,700 civilian employees there. Elected officials like the Senators Ayotte and Shaheen typically fight tooth and nail to keep the jobs here in New Hampshire. We also have Susan Collins of Maine who has an interest in it as well. What's interesting here is both Senators Shaheen and Ayotte are on the Senate Armed Services Committee, and they have leadership positions on the subcommittee that deals specifically with base realignment and closure. So that's a pretty nice way to sort of give New Hampshire a little bit of advantage. But, you know, they're going to be working very hard. I'm sure our Congresswoman Custer and Shea Porter will as well to try to keep the base open. We don't know yet exactly what's going to be recommended, but clearly both Senator Shaheen and Ayotte have been out in front already saying that the shipyard needs to remain open, or they're going to work their best to keep it off the list.
And as you said, Dean, you know, this has come up before. Every time somebody says Defense Department cut, someone else says, what about Portsmouth? Josh, talk a little bit more about what Senators Ayotte and Shaheen specifically are saying and doing on this.
Well, I mean, they're basically saying hell no. And they, as Dean mentioned, they're very well positioned to make that stick. It's a weird circumstance in which they are the ranking member on the subcommittee of each party. And it's odd in a circumstance where you have split delegation, basically, that you would have the advantage of having the top Democrat and the top Republican positioned that way. And it's difficult to say what's ultimately going to come of Secretary Hagel's recommendation and when we get to a more granular level. But the shipyard's in a decent shape based on Ayotte and Shaheen's status.
Yeah, and I think last time this came around, Kevin, the shipyard came out with flying colors. Because I remember talking about this a couple years ago.
They did. It was on the base closure list in 2005. It was discussed as being perhaps on one that they talked about having in 2010. There haven't been base closures approved by Congress since 2005. What really upset both New Hampshire senators was in Chuck Hagel's speech. Now, keep in mind now, this Chuck Hagel, former U.S. senator, essentially said to the Congress, look, if you continue to cut my budget and you won't allow me to close bases, then I'll explore the options I believe I have. Well, this poor guy named Robert Work happened to be the nominee for Deputy Defense Secretary the following day before the Senate Armed Services Committee after Chuck Hagel's speech. Ayotte was all over him like a cheap suit and basically said, what authority are you talking about? Hagel doesn't have any authority to do anything that Congress doesn't let him do. And Work did a lot of backfilling and backpedaling, I should say, as well, and essentially said, I'll find out what authority. I believe I've heard the secretary say he has certain powers, but, and this is the important but those powers would only kick in if you authorized a base closure. See, the Congress in the past has actually authorized base closures. Then when we get down to discussing, okay, which bases are we going to close?
Close somebody else's base.
None get closed. They can't get an agreement on anything. So, Work was essentially saying, Congress, yes, you would have to authorize a round of base closures. We could then perhaps go in and decide on our own which ones we close. That's a non-starter with Senators Ayotte and Shaheen, and they have the clout to stop it.
Well, and Pease was closed, gosh, back in the mid to late 90s,
yes.
Kevin, and despite all the hue and cry, has turned out to be a success story. That's an economic engine on the seacoast.
It really is, and that's worked very well. But one of the arguments about these base closures is the cost to close, has a GAO report, General Accounting Office report, was the cost to close the bases was five times more than the estimates to close.
Wow. All right. Dean, I know you want to jump in.
Yeah. What's so interesting about this from a political perspective and why I like to watch these very closely is, you know, in many cases around the country, this is really an argument about jobs and the economy, but you can't couch it that way. You have to couch it as an argument about national security. So sure, you know, there are 5,000 civilian employees, but what we're going to hear are arguments about, you know, being prepared and national security and the need for particular classes of, you know, weaponry or ships or submarines or whatever. What have you. So it's an economic issue around the country, but it has to be couched as a national security one. And that's always interesting to listen to.
And nobody's going to talk about the budgetary implications.
No, that's sort of secondary. No, it's really all, you know, you're going to talk all about why we need to build X, Y, or Z system at a particular base or have a particular base remain open.
Again, our number for you to join the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Join us with your thoughts on this story if you'd like. The prospect of Defense Department cuts raising concerns about the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard. We've talked about other headlines as well, and you can join us on those at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Dean, I did want to ask you about another seacoast-related story. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, as most people know it, announced this week $33 million in disaster relief funding to Northeast fishery communities. It's a lot of money. I think the total was $75 million for the whole country. So $33 million for the Northeast is a lot. What's the disaster, though, Dean? Usually a disaster sounds like a one-time event.
Right. This is something that probably flies under the radar for most people. You know, you hear occasional stories about the state of the fishing industry in New England in particular. I mean, I think it's a combination of, you know, overfishing of the stocks in the region, foreign competition. There are a number of different factors that have led into the industry no longer being economically viable for many of the people who have engaged in it for generations. So back in September 2012, the government declared this sort of the fishery is a federal disaster. And as you said, they approved $75 million and 33 are going to New York and New England. The question now is going to be how to spend that money. Is it to give direct relief to people who have been kind of dislocated from the industry or other types of measures that may help the remaining aspects of the industry, you know, stay in place?
All right. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Josh, I did want to follow up with you on a story that we've talked about a lot on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and that's the fate of Jim Reams, Rockingham County attorney, mysteriously suspended late last year. It's still unclear why, but Reams said this week he won't run for re-election. A surprise or expected, Josh? What do you think?
Hard to know. I mean, it's been hanging out there. I mean, I certainly, you know, he says he's decided not to run to more or less. He doesn't want his problems to overshadow the debate about the future of his office, which doesn't necessarily sound like the statement of somebody who believes he's going to be fully exonerated. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's been a tough spot for him. And it's been, you know, without real precedent that I've been able to locate about, you know, how long this has been ongoing where an elected official is, you know, stripped of his authority. And we don't really know why. He's yet to be charged. You know, he's expected to be back in court next month. And, you know, there are indications that we're probably going to learn what's exactly at stake. There have been talk about financial mismanagement, and there were also talk about sort of a, you know, hostile work environment towards women. And so we'll see. But, you know, Jim Reams had been in the job for a long time. I mean, he was first elected in, I think, 1998, and has been, you know, active politically, more political than a lot of other county attorneys.
Yeah, it's a tough story to cover, Kevin Landrigan, because as Josh alluded, you don't really know what's happening with this case.
No, you don't. I mean, but one of the things that's interesting in talking with Republicans since this word has come out from Jim Reams, I sense from some of them, at the beginning there was a lot of sympathy a lot of concern for Jim Reams, feeling as if he was the victim. What I hear privately from Republicans now is Josh just alluded to in his commentary, which essentially is if you're innocent, you run for re-election to clear your name. If you're not innocent, you don't run again, and you try and do the – you try and generate the best plea bargain you possibly can to what could ultimately be criminal charges.
So what do you think, Dean? Where does this end up? We're going to know more in a couple weeks. Are people just going to forget about this and move on?
Yeah, you know, there was that initial flurry of activity, and there was a tremendous amount of media coverage and scrutiny to the extent there was really anything available to scrutinize. You know, this is probably going to go on for a while. It really has faded a little bit from the news headlines. He is in limbo, as we've suggested. You know, even if he's not going to run for office again, he wants to be able to practice law so that he can make a living. So there are all kinds of other issues, but, you know, I think it's just going to pop up from time to time. But it is interesting the extent to which there's been kind of an information vacuum around this.
Well, there's also hasn't been any indication that things have kind of leapt off the rails in his absence in Rockingham County. I mean, the reports have been that the climate over there in the county attorney's office, there's at least no public griping. Things seem to be working smoothly. There have been no complaints about the processing of cases and that sort of thing. So, you know, right now, Jim Buffetti, who's, you know, senior assistant attorney general, is in acting county attorney. And, you know, that seems to be going relatively smoothly.
So if there have been problems, it might be a bigger deal. You know, I want to ask you, Josh, about a story I know you're going to be covering next week, but I want to ask you now about it. The local, even though the legislature is not in session this week, local Republican committees have been gearing up for a big Medicaid expansion vote next week. This, again, is the idea that do we expand Medicaid or not? Republicans in the Senate finally decided, yes, we'll go along with this, but we'll call it something else. But now the local committees are chiming in, Josh. What are they saying?
Well, they're essentially saying that, you know, we don't support the expansion of Medicaid, that it's, you know, part and parcel of Obamacare, and that they're taking votes. And, you know, these votes have been piling up. They started last week. And, you know, at this point, the local GOP committees in Manchester, Bedford, Merrimack, Rockingham and Stratford counties, I mean, areas where there are a lot of Republicans, have all taken votes essentially condemning support for this bill to, you know, we'll call it expanded Medicaid. Senate Republican leaders say that it's using federal money to purchase private insurance for people who wouldn't be entitled to it. We're talking about 50,000 people. And you know, it's an interesting tension. You have, you know, Chuck Morris and Jeb Bradley, the two most powerful Republicans in Concord, Foursquare in support of this. And you have, you know, local Republican committee saying, you know, hell no, and saying that this isn't part of the GOP platform is to oppose Obamacare, and we will see where this goes. I mean, the votes are going to be there to pass this. The upshot down the road is unclear. This issue is going to hang over every candidate who's running. And, you know, I guess we'll see what happens.
Yeah, it is interesting. And so how does that work, Kevin, that, you know, a local committee such as the ones Josh mentioned says, no, we don't like this at all. They can't tell senators how to vote, but they can make life difficult for them.
They can. And we have conservative groups that have already pledged to make life difficult for particularly Senate Republicans who vote for this package. And there will be at least four or five. There could be as many as 8 or 9 Senate Republicans who end up voting for this. Americans for Prosperity is the state chapter here that has been growing in some strength, is dead set against it. The leader of the Republican Liberty Caucus has said, we will find Republican primary opponents to run against Senate Republicans who vote for this. I think what fuels a lot of this, frankly, is the Affordable Care Act and how it's affecting people who don't qualify for Medicaid. After all, as we've talked about on this program many times, 10 hospitals are not in the network under the exchange. So if you have individual health insurance, you may live in a community where your hospital is no longer in the network. That makes people very unhappy. It makes them feel, in other words, as if people who are getting taxpayer-paid for health care are getting better coverage and better access to coverage than I am, and I'm paying for it.
Well, and we would be remiss, Dean Spiliotis, if we didn't give brief mention to the fact that Hampton Beach may be the star of a new reality TV show. The production company that's made such hit reality TV shows such as Here Comes Honey Boo Boo may be planning a reality TV show like Jersey Shore based on, drumroll, Hampton Beach. Wow.
Yes, this is Authentic Entertainment, which is based in Burbank, California. As you mentioned,
that's the company.
Yes,
yeah.
That's the company. They're known for Here Comes Honey Boo Boo and Toddlers and Tiaras, among other basic cable shows. And apparently they placed an ad on Craigslist, a casting call for 18 to 30-year-olds who spend their summers in Hampton Beach. And so the idea here would be it would be sort of a New Hampshire version of the Jersey Shore. Hampton Beach officials have said that they have not had any contacts yet. There were a number of approvals that would be necessary to film. None of that is happening, so they're sort of taking a wait-and-see attitude. You know, there is some concern that because it's a casting call and the success of the Jersey Shore, they would bring people in from other parts of the country who say they hang out in Hampton Beach, so it wouldn't be an authentic New Hampshire experience. And there's always concern that it might, if there's a lot of drinking and other types of shenanigans, it wouldn't reflect well on New Hampshire.
Well, the casting call said, if you like to party and get in trouble.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, well, and given the Jersey Shore. Yeah. So, you know, we may in a few years have our own JWoww, Snooki, and the situation.
Well, according to Seacoast Online, the chair of the Hampton Beach Area Commission said, oh, God, that doesn't sound good. So I don't know how thrilled they are in Hampton Beach about this image, but we shall see. Next week on The Exchange, guys, we've got a lot going on. In particular, we're going to sit down with UNH President Mark Huddleston. His State of the University speech recently created a lot of talk about what higher education is and what it is not. Kevin Landergan, what are you going to be tracking next week?
We'll talk about the gas tax, which looks like it's gaining some momentum. The Senate committee is going to vote on the recommendation, and the reason it's gaining momentum is the sponsor is essentially willing to drop the idea of indexing the gas tax.
That's a big deal.
So it would automatically come up because business groups have said they're in favor of a gas tax increase. They're not in favor of making one automatic in the future.
Josh, how about you?
Certainly gas tax and Medicaid.
Okay, and Dean, besides Honey Boo Boo and Hampton Beach?
I plan to be back here next week talking about Bob Smith and maybe a little Medicaid, too.
All right, great. Good to see all of you. Thank you very much for being here. Dean Spiliotis, Josh Rogers, and Kevin Landergan. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Mikesell. Our intern is James Pouliot. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, we begin with an update on the abortion debate. Both sides are promoting bills nationally and in New Hampshire. Then UNH President Mark Huddleston joins us on his recent State of the University speech, where he said higher education is not a commodity to purchase at Walmart prices. And later, part two in our series on teachers, how we educate our educators. Send us your thoughts by email, Facebook, and join us all next week for The Exchange. Every morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio with the Diane Rehm Show next at 10 o'clock. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Vintage Kitchens of Concord, enduring designs that balance clients' needs with the home's architectural features, online at vintagekitchens.com. And from Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank, banking solutions customized to your business. Information available at centrixbank.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH
Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
It's 10 o'clock.
Line.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Catty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel's 2015 military budget proposal would reduce the U.S. Army to pre-World War II levels. President Obama calls on Congress to fund infrastructure projects by reforming the nation's tax code. He discusses the proposal during a private meeting